Hello and welcome to the first edition of the Sports Gazette's Book Club podcast. We're here today to go over the shortlist for the William Hill Sports Book of the Year Award. We've read all the books and we're ready to share our thoughts with you, our trusted audience. Julia, what did you read?
Yeah, I read Concussed, Sports Uncomfortable Truth by Sam Peters. He's been a rugby journalist, and over the past 9 years, he's started concussion campaigns for the Daily Mail and continued it as a freelancer, and has now put all of his knowledge about concussion, research, all the interviews he's ever done in one place into this very interesting book.
I'm Laura, and I read Sharon Davies' Unfair Play, The Battle for Women's Sport. I think I probably drew the short straw a bit here, but Davies is an ex-Olympic swimmer and foregrounded the book in the systematic doping of Cold War era East Germany. And I think those experiences go on to inform her later views in the book, but certainly from my perspective don't justify them. She argues that transgender athletes are also a kind of continuation of this anti-women doping, as she likes to put it, but I completely disagree with that, and I'm sure we'll expand on why that is.
My name's George, and I read Good for a Girl, A Woman Running in a Man's World by Lauren Fleshman. It's a memoir of her life as a professional runner. She talks about her battles with sexism, eating disorders, and also it includes her observation of the way that women and men are treated within the track and field world.
I'm Ayush, and I've got Sam with me here, and we both read Althea, The Life of Tennis Champion Althea Gibson. It's written by Sally Jacobs, who's a former Pulitzer winner. And as I expected, it's fantastic. It talks not just about Althea Gibson's life and her career, but there's so much more, so many important things going on in the US and the world during that time. And we'll get into it.
I'm Alicia Singh, and I just finished reading Unbreakable by 7-time world champion Ronnie O'Sullivan. It was a fantastic book and I absolutely loved it. Unbreakable is about as up to date as you can get, with the final chapters being about the 2022 Snooker World Championships and a lot of references to 2023. It's a book that really challenges what people think they know about Ronnie O'Sullivan. For example, that he coasts through everything through his sheer talent rather than his hard work.
I read Catherine Scanlon's Kick the Latch. I approached the book as a complete novice in the world of horse racing, but I still managed to really enjoy it, and I think it's a credit to the writing style. It's a refreshing take on the sports book, written in the first person, and it's actually the only fictional work on the shortlist. Julia, what do you like most about Sam Peters' work?
Well, going into it, I know very little about rugby. More on the concussion side of things is what I know, and the research side of things, but I was really amazed by how he was able to weave the two aspects together. Really, the way he was able to tell like former athletes, parents who've lost their children from concussions and brain injuries in sport, family members of professional athletes, the way that he was able to share their stories and weave research into it so you knew he wasn't just, you know, trying to pull at emotional heartstrings. It was really, really impressive, and there were certain parts where I had to take a step away because it was just a really hard, hard read.
And are there any stories in particular that stood out to you?
Yeah, the one that kind of got Sam Peters going in his concussion campaign that he started with the Daily Mail is what sticks out the most to me. And it was when George Smith, in I believe 2013, he came out of international retirement for a tour in Australia. And it was his first game back with the international team in 4 years, and he got hit really hard. And right away, Sam Peters was at the game, and he knew that George Smith was going to get back on the field. Sam said that for bystanders, it was really difficult to watch, but he knew that George Smith was going to get back out there. Sure enough, he did, and he ended up actually getting hit again. So he had two serious brain injuries just within one game.
So it sounds like there are a lot of really hard-hitting kind of aspects to the book, and it's obviously discussing a topic that's, you know, growing in its kind of prevalence and its importance in a whole kind of sporting and obviously specifically rugby conversation. Were there any aspects that, despite the kind of maybe sort of muted nature of some of the passages, that were slightly more kind of uplifting or anything like that?
Despite the fact that there are still issues in the game of rugby, it's pretty clear that rugby is actually probably further along than a lot of sports in their protocol for concussion. And Sam says that one of the peddlers of some inaccurate information for a very long time that had a lot of sway in world rugby, just a couple years ago, it came out that he had essentially made up or changed some of his data. And this is research that people who questioned how serious concussion was, like, really hung on to. And he was found out, so he's no longer really high up in rugby. They kind of kicked him out. He's no longer the editor of the journal that he was editor of for over a decade. So although there's a lot of trust that needs to be rebuilt between rugby governing bodies, players, fans, everything, they are moving in the right direction. They're clearing out people who have lied and put people's lives at risk for far too long. So they are moving in the correct direction.
Just a question, like, is there a hidden motivation behind why they were kind of masking up the concussion research?
I mean, what does a lot of business come down to? Money. These athletes were thought of as almost commodities. So the research, it was funded by World Rugby and the different international governing bodies. So if the person who is funding the research wants it to show that everything's cool, concussion doesn't lead to long-term impacts, then what are they going to find? It's the same thing that, you know, soda industries do. Coca-Cola funds, you know, to be like, sugar's not that bad. It's the exact same thing here. And so, especially because it's a long-term issue a lot of times, you know, it's something that they just don't have to, they didn't have to deal with at the moment, but it was hard to read.
Yeah, it really reminds me of kind of like the smoking campaigns they used to run, especially in America as well, like Marlboro and stuff like that, basically saying that cigarettes are good for you. And that they're not going to cause cancer and stuff, and then you move on to...
Sam Peters talks about that and how it was the exact same thing, like, oh, we can't prove that concussions, multiple concussions and multiple head injuries lead to early onset dementia. Like, there could be other things. It's like, no, we do, and he compares it to the tobacco industry, actually, and they are very similar because there was decades worth of research, but people were saying, nope, you can't see the direct link.
I find it really interesting that you're kind of talking about this bias within research, because I think that was one of the main problems I potentially had with my book, and I had so many, I could be here all day, but particularly on the kind of research front, it's definitely something that I picked up on in this book, because it just feels like the research within this book, and I read Unfair Play, and kind of trying to tackle this really complex debate about the inclusion of transgender athletes, and she calls it the transgender debate firstly, which it isn't. There is no debate about transgender rights. It's a debate that might be a broader thing about how can we tackle that, and not tackle that, but how can we approach that within sporting world. But the kind of way she and the terminology she uses is completely wrong. And I think that undermines her arguments from the very off, the way she kind of approaches it and tackles it. But I also think that then she goes into this in kind of cherry picking research that suits her purpose, and there's very little to kind of justify why she's picked that research or who's particularly doing that research, and the people that she does. I mean, in fairness, as the book goes along, she does kind of expand and she does kind of bring in opposing research, but that research is very easily kind of, the research she picks to kind of go against or to oppose is very flimsily done, and you just feel like whoever's funding that research, as you've kind of mentioned, or whoever that's kind of gonna come from, and the bias they're gonna have, there's always kind of a motive. And I think she can pick all this research that she wants, but there's always research on the other side that she doesn't necessarily tackle, and I just think the way this book is done is very biased in one corner. And if you don't come in with that perspective of knowing that there is this breadth of research out there that you can kind of pick a side and pick which research you want, it's quite misleading.
And it sounds like almost in your case, it's not so much even necessarily biased research. It's the fact that maybe she doesn't know how to interpret the research. Because, again, I don't think a lot of researchers are going out there to put out biased work. It's just the fact that where's the funding coming from? What are the research methods being used? And also whoever's then reading whatever comes of it, the papers after your research, do they know how to interpret it? And in Sharon Davies' case, sounds like the answer may be no.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think some of the examples she uses, and I do think that, not that they're trying to bias anything, but I think these researchers are approaching the debate with an agenda. And there's, of course, if you pick something that you want to prove, there's probably ways that you can prove it. So we're talking about kind of a history of sex testing within athletics, within sport, within swimming, where different kind of markers of what supposedly is sex or gender are kind of used. And throughout history, we can see this kind of approach that they just pick a different marker each time to kind of make it fit to the environment at the time. So we saw, like, obviously there's big claims about East Germany, but at that time there were different markers. They weren't using testosterone, they were using kind of these different tests that you can kind of go into a lot more, I won't hear, and now they use kind of these testosterone markers. But there's so many other problems around that, which she calls gotchas, which I think is completely the wrong way to approach it. But you've got women with naturally higher levels of testosterone that were born biologically as a woman.
I think it's quite interesting how she calls it unfair play, and she's using like the terminology of gotcha, and it makes it sound like it's on a school playground, and it seems quite immature, especially when I've just like read the blurb here. She says unfair play provides the facts, science and arguments that will help women in sport get their justice they deserve. That sounds quite empowering. But the way that obviously she goes through the book, it really does seem it's just her perhaps trying to claw back some significance in terms of her career.
Yeah, for me it's quite troubling because she kind of approaches it from, as I said before, the perspective of East Germany in the past and their doping, which was doping and was unfair, and no one's taking that away from her. She was cheated out of a gold medal. That's fine, that's completely right. But then she uses that as like a foreground to say, look, this is just a continuation. And that's absolutely not what it is. Like, she shows the evidence of the history, and that's absolutely correct. You know, she shows the athletes who did it, she shows that it was systematic, she shows that there were so many athletes involved in that. But then at the same time, she also has this kind of continuation into a debate which is so much more nuanced. She dead names multiple people, and I just think taking that approach is really problematic, and it suggests to people who aren't necessarily immersed in this debate that it is a continuation, and I just don't think it is, and I think that's kind of lacking nuance.
And do you feel that kind of emotional context of bitterness about that injustice, do you think that's kind of filtered into her perceptions and the views that she expresses in this book in a way that she can't really see the issue clearly? She's relating it so much to such a kind of painful experience in her career.
For sure. I think it really comes through how hurt she is by that experience. And I mean, she speaks about how her family have recently kind of gifted her the silver medals that she won. They've got them gold plated. So she does have a gold medal. And I think that's clearly something that continues to burn. And I completely understand that that can be kind of a cause and something that would cause kind of injustice. But you can't then bring that on to kind of a whole group of people and say these people are doing exactly the same thing and it's misogynistic, and she talks about this whole like history of Olympic misogyny when it's just simply not the same thing. And I think she's actually trying to fight this supposed patriarchy that want transgender athletes, but actually she doesn't realize that it's the patriarchy she's on the side of the patriarchy now, who don't want transgender athletes inclusion.
Laura, you also talk about a lot of the weaknesses in the book, and there's obviously a lot of bias, but what are the strengths of the book?
Yeah, I mean, I do think, you know, the first couple of chapters, do give a strong history of the kind of events, and it's quite interesting because obviously she was personally there to experience that. So there is that kind of personal element of giving a strong history of what it was actually like to be at those Olympic Games when there was a lot of doping, and kind of she was saying how they all socialised in the athletes' village, and then the kind of athletes from East Germany were just not allowed to kind of be involved in that. So I think that was maybe one of the strengths, but I think throughout that it's kind of marred by having little references that I would perceive as transphobic throughout that.
And in this idea that that transgender athletes are perpetuating unfair play, I think there's kind of an implicit idea that transgender athletes are transgender because they want to cheat. How much do you think that's a kind of minimization of what it means to be transgender and the reasons why people become transgender?
Absolutely. I completely agree with what you're saying, and I think that's really reflected in this book. And I think she's very, very dismissive of kind of the sense of internal identification with gender. And I don't think she understands gender because I don't think she's ever had to kind of interact with that. I think it's very, very clear that she's never really interacted with the ideas of people having different gender identities. And obviously she's very privileged in the fact that she's never had to kind of deal with that herself or kind of come into contact with that maybe. And I think she could do a lot of work on that herself. And I think throughout the book, she's kind of saying, just in the way she refers to people, just in the way she kind of approaches the subject and the terminology she uses, I think it's really inflammatory at points. And she says, people are going to call me transphobic. So if you're aware of that, why aren't you doing some reflection? Why aren't you thinking, how can I actually be better? How can I be more inclusive and maybe not dead naming people, for example? There is so much more nuance to put into this debate that just isn't at all kind of covered in this book. And I think it's a complete injustice to the whole trans community, this entire book.
And you mentioned there the kind of idea that she's caught up in a very extreme position. How do you feel this book is a reflection on the polarity that has emerged in this debate? And how do we go forward from there and find more healthy ways to explore what is a really important and nuanced conversation?
I think it's really difficult because I think I certainly approached this book, and I was told not to, in kind of don't approach this book with a kind of preconceived idea about this whole conversation. And I personally found that really hard because I don't understand how you can approach a debate like this, a conversation like this, when it's got people's rights at stake. And I think that's what she's failed to recognise. And I think as soon as we start humanising the debate and thinking, okay, we're actually talking about people here, we're not talking about whether your child is going to be safe in sport. That's not what this debate is about. This debate is about making sure people feel welcome, they feel belonging within playing sport. And we all know the power of sport to create that belonging. And I think we need to start seeing that for everyone. And whether that conversation goes to an elite level and we have to look at more nuance, because obviously there is still conversations to be had about how we address that. And I don't think anyone kind of denies that, but I think the way it's being done at the moment isn't humane.
I think this like really kind of segues well onto kind of what my book speaks about. So my book was Good for a Girl by Lauren Fleshman. And pretty much it's a memoir of her experience as an athlete. And she really talks about her issues that she personally experienced, but also the athletes around her and their experience within the sport as well. And I think the central kind of argument of the book is that women are treated unfairly in sport. And that's not to say that it's anything like Sharon Davis's book at all, because it is just not. This is about realization over her lifetime that the book starts when she's 14 and just takes up running, and she starts smashing records and she's like doing amazingly. And it's not until she gets to like the kind of higher levels where she's noticing, like, she went to a competition and she was sat around, she was eating a burger and the girls around her were eating salads the night before a race. And she goes, am I doing something wrong? Like, personally, I look bigger than all these girls. And then she goes into struggling with body image and the fact that she's beating these girls, but she kind of sees this yearning like to push to that next level. Maybe she needs to look like other girls. Yes, Johnny.
And with it being a biographical approach to the subject, how do you feel the kind of emotional impact of some of these ideas, these damaging ideas about body image in sport? How do you feel the emotional impact of that come through?
I think, just like, I just got goosebumps you saying that, because personally, as an athlete myself, I have experienced things where I've lost weight, and that's not like on like purposefully, but I've gone on the scales and gone, oh my God, I've lost a stone. How's that happened? And there is obviously this education that people need to understand that everyone's different. People can shed weight really easily, but that doesn't mean it's healthy. And the way that she talks about it is that she's been told, oh, you're 61 kilograms now. But when you were racing your great, great times, you were 55 kilograms. Now, that's rather problematic. She doesn't blame the person that told her that, her coach. She doesn't blame him for that. But what she blames is the system saying that you need to be at race weight. And it's also the system not doing enough research about females' bodies and the way females interact with sport. And actually, when you're young, and especially when you're getting your periods, they need to be regular because that monitors your bone health. The research is done on men. Men don't have periods. Men's bone health is not determined by a time of the month when they need to have that period. So the fact that all the research is done on a man and they're trying to pretty much apply it to a woman, it just goes to show that there's so much more that needs to be done in the sport for researching women's health as well.
Yeah, it was just really interesting to kind of touch on both of those points that you just made. Do you feel it was did she attribute it to the culture maybe of athletics, or more to that gender data gap of not having the information and therefore just not knowing enough?
I think at the end of the day, it's actually both. There is obviously a deep-rooted thing that the marketing aspect of skinny women in, as she puts it, in pretty much swimsuits, they're more marketable than men. They can charge more if a woman is white, blonde-haired, and beautiful, as she puts it. And they can get more money through that, and they can sell more products through that. Because at the end of the day, it's very gendered. And I think a lot of men would probably watch athletics and go, oh, she's quite an attractive woman. But you don't look at them. Men aren't really paid for that looks. They're paid for that performance. And I think that the fact that, because it's very gendered in that way, then that's why people women especially start to look at themselves and go, to get more money, I need to be marketable. I need to look beautiful. And unfortunately, it kind of the general aspect of it is if you look in a magazine at Victoria's Secret models, all of them are about 6 or 7 stone, very skinny, very slight built. And that's actually not what an athlete looks like. So that's obviously one aspect of it that is just like a problem with society.
Yeah, so you spoke about some of the problems that she's, you know, she's highlighted when it comes, of course, the inequality that's in athletics and the system. But I'm sure that there are a lot more other problems as well that are going on. Of course, maybe she's not highlighted all of those. So do you think, are there problems that she's, other problems as well she's highlighted, and how good of a job do you think she's done through the book to shine light on those things?
Yeah, there are many arguments and things that she poses to the readers. It can just be simple things that's not body image at all. It can be actually contractual negotiations within the sport. So, for an example, Nike was paying her, or Nike, should I say, for Julia.
Thank you.
And also for all our international listeners, because it is pronounced Nike, because they are an American brand. But Nike were paying her $100,000. She got injured, and that was, she admits it was due to under-eating to try and get to her race weight. She was skipping periods, her bone health went down, her bone shattered. Because she wasn't racing, they halved her pay and she was told it was written into her contract that once they half her pay, she's never going to go back up to 100,000. She's going to stay at 50,000. She's got a mortgage, she's got a house. How can you expect to live if you're not getting paid the same? You budget for the money you get. As soon as they take that away from you, they can take it away from you like that. It's gone. And it's just a big problem within a lot of brands. I'm not saying all brands, but especially Nike is a big brand. They're performance orientated. They see, oh, she's not racing anymore. Why does she need the money? It's ridiculous.
Pardon me, I don't know a whole lot about her story. When was she running? Like, what era was she from?
So she began running in the 90s, and her Olympic career, she never got to the Olympics, but she was racing until 2012.
Okay.
Yeah.
Does she reflect on kind of how things have changed or where she'd like the industry to go in the future?
Yeah, so actually quite interestingly, the final chapter is almost like a redemption story, and it's her impact that she's now having in athletics. So she's teamed up with a brand called Wazelle, and basically the brand is very women orientated and very feminist, and they're improving the way that contract negotiations are. So she has an elite team of female runners, and they don't talk about performance first. They talk about health first, mm-hmm. and the performances come after the health. So she's the coach of that brand. And also within that brand, the contractor negotiations are, they can go and have children. They won't lose money. Their contract continues. Whereas Nike freezes their contract as soon as they become pregnant. Yeah, so there's a lot of ways to go. A New York Times documentary did come out way before her book and a few years ago. And it was very interesting to see that she talks about that within the book.
So your book sounds like it ends somewhat on a little bit more of a high note, maybe a little bit more of a positive. For Sam and Ayush, your book, you're talking a little bit to me beforehand about how maybe that is less so the case.
Yeah, so it's all about Althea Gibson, who is a black tennis player kind of born in the sort of back end of the 1920s in America. She was unbelievably successful throughout her career, but it's broadly been overlooked, not least in kind of tennis history, but also in kind of black history specifically. The kind of ending of the book isn't really positive at all, in that she was kind of almost abandoned by the sort of tennis world and a lot of America even more generally, and was calling up friends and colleagues saying that she was going to commit suicide and that she had nothing to live for. And so despite what is actually a tremendously beautiful story of and quite an uplifting, important tale that's been told, it actually doesn't feature all that much joy. And it's almost quite sad that she had to go through so much hardship, but the story that's emerged is really beautiful, and that possibly she never really recognised the kind of legacy that she had there.
Sally says, you know, there's a line she uses in the book, and it says, she was after all challenging the barriers, not just of race, but of gender and class. I think that says a lot about Althea's story, because it really wasn't about race. And I think Sally Jacobs has done a very good job highlighting all of the problems that Althea faced. I mean, the US Open, as it is right now, the Billie Jean King National Tennis Center, where the US Open is played, the main showcase stadium, the main stadium where all the biggest matches happen, is called the Arthur Ashe Stadium. And Arthur Ashe wasn't a pioneer of the black community. It was Althea Gibson. And there's been no mention of Althea Gibson for so many years. Arthur Ashe, back when he was, you know, a budding tennis player, actually said many times that Althea Gibson was an inspiration, because she was the first black athlete to do so many things in tennis. She was the first. There are many firsts in her career, not just for herself, but for the community. And I think it's really important that this story be told. And I think the way Sally Jacobs has told the story. It's just fantastic. I loved it.
Yeah, that's really interesting, Ayush. How do you think Althea's story can impact the way we look at sport today and the way we try and change sport today?
That's the thing. I mean, there's so much back from then that we're still fighting, and it's been about 70, 80 years since Althea started playing, and 100 years, 100 years since she was born. I think it was the late 1920s and stuff. So, yeah, the fight for equal pay is still going on. I mean, there's a lot of improvement. We've seen the Grand Slams now all have equal pay, and Billie Jean King has done a lot of work for that. But again, Billie Jean King also said that Althea Gibson was her inspiration. So it's just someone like Althea, and it was a very conflicting, situation in her career as well, because back then, Althea was supposed to be the flag bearer of the black community and to stand for everything that the community represented, but she never wanted anything to do with that. And she always said that, yes, I know that, you know, a lot of people in the community are looking at me as an example, but I just want my accomplishments and my individual, the way I do things and how much I win, the way I conduct myself as a tennis player, to speak louder than me being the first black person to do that, or, you know, the person of color to do this, or whatever. Today, I think, Sally speaks about Serena Williams as well. And, you know, in a very nice way, she explains that Serena Williams is considered the biggest champion tennis player of the black community, but it was Althea Gibson who actually put a racket in her hands. Because if there was no Althea Gibson, there was no Serena or Venus. And just the way, I think, Sam, if you remember, the way the book starts itself, it speaks about King Richard, right? Where there was a shot of Will Smith and I forgot who plays the mother of the Williams sisters in the movie, but they're arguing. And on the fridge behind them, there was a scene where there was actually a photo of Althea Gibson. And when Sally Jacobs spoke to people on the set and people who had worked in the movie, many of them did not even know who the photo of the woman was. And that's telling. From Althea Gibson's example, we have seen a lot of improvement, be it, when it comes to gender equality or racial equality and stuff like that, but there's still a long way to go. They need to learn from her that, you know, especially the people of the community, that they need to continue to drive home the point.
Yeah, so I think what really stood out to me was the fact that the book starts by giving a really rich and detailed account of actually what it was like to grow up in Harlem and what it was like to be a young black person growing up in America. And Althea faced several personal challenges, not least her father being incredibly abusive to her throughout much of her childhood. I think he first actually punched her when she was just 12. And the stark line is that she punched him straight back. And this was a kind of really regular occurrence in the community and in her upbringing, essentially. What's nice is it's framed within this sort of Harlem Renaissance, is what it's referred to in the book. And this kind of cultural flowering where a lot of jazz was being sort of created, and film and various things like that also coincided with sport growing. So baseball began to really expand, and I think the first black basketball team was kind of formed during this period. But as Ayush touched on, Althea Gibson never really received the wholehearted backing of the black community, whereas sort of baseball pioneers did, and they had that support throughout their careers. Jackie Robinson was a big baseball pioneer, and she really had the community behind her. And Althea was so conflicted about this, she didn't necessarily want to represent the Black community. She, through her upbringing, had sort of been guided down a path of individuality and making her own way out against everyone else, and triumph and victory was the main focus, and she was trying to get there herself, not in any way to represent a community that she was perceived to be part of.
So Sam, that's really interesting. Who do you think the target audience is for this book then?
Quite frankly, I think the target audience is a whole manner of people. I mean, it's such a brilliant history. It's such an important conversation about race, about gender, about class. It kind of manages to tackle a whole lot of issues. And what I think Ayush and I have really spoken about is, despite the fact that we're huge tennis fans, there's no requirement here to love tennis or to be really interested in race or class. It's such a kind of broad church of ideas, this book, and yet it's framed so sensitively with Althea Gibson as the sort of main guiding force throughout the book. And so I think I'd really hope that this book is read by more people, and I'm excited to see how it does at the awards, because in my opinion, I think it's a worthy winner. So I suppose we'll have to see how it all pans out.
And I can see some level of similarity between our two books, even though one's obviously a biography, whereas mine's a fictional work. But Catherine Scanlon's Kick the Latch is really telling a lost story, telling a story that you might not otherwise know unless you read the book. And it is very much grounded in a set of transcribed interviews with a female horse trainer named Sonia. And it tells the story of this kind of humble female horse trainer who falls in love with the animals when they're 5 years old. They initially think about being a jockey, and to meet the kind of diminutive standards of a jockey, they put heavy books on their head, they do that kind of thing. But they eventually emerge on the racetracks as a trainer, not as a rider. And it is one of those stories where it brings you into this world. And even though it is a fictional work, it's been kind of altered, you can feel the realness behind it. You can feel that it's come from someone's genuine life experiences.
So do you think there's sort of growing room for this kind of fictional sports book kind of hybrid? Because it sounds like a really interesting way of presenting a story. How do you think sort of the other five books could have embraced a kind of fictional aspect of it?
Yeah, it's a great question, Sam. I feel like reading the book, for me, it was really refreshing to read a sports book that took a different approach to trying to bring you into a certain kind of sporting world. It was immensely readable. It's only 167 pages, and it follows the style of a diary written in the first person. And I think there is so much room for that kind of creative format in the world of sports literature, which can sometimes be a bit dense, a bit overzealous in terms of detail. And I think what I loved about the book is the way that you really connected with this character while they were at the horse track, while they were kind of experiencing everything that went on there, which, because this is a world that's simultaneously very, very charming, but it's also very cruel. You know, she keeps a butcher's knife by her bed, and she's proven right in having that caution because she faces, you know, robbery, she faces sexual assault. But on the other hand, she also, you know, makes many good friends at the track. She develops rituals. They do all sorts of pranks, you know, hiding each other's horses, this kind of thing. You know, the usual stuff you do. But yeah, I think that's what really stands out about Catherine's book, is that it is so immersive and it is so fun to be kind of brought into that world.
So out of all the books, Johnny, I have to admit, I did have a Google search in it to see what people were saying about your book, because I do think my book is going to win. I'm going to put that out there, everybody. And your book is said to be magical and compulsively readable. So my question to you is, what is your favourite part of the book then?
Well, first of all, I think it's a bit bold to suggest that Ronnie O'Sullivan's will win when he's not even set to attend the awards. But I would say my favourite part of the book is probably in the early chapters. I think if I had any criticism of the book, it would be that
it loses the sense of detail that it had in the early stages towards the end of the story, and maybe feels a bit like it's rushing towards the end. It could have maybe fleshed out across 20 or so more pages, but the thing I really enjoyed was getting the sense that this horse trainer has a real affinity for the animal, and you saw that carry throughout the book and distinguish her as a special horse trainer, as one who kind of sees a horse who others would want to discard and takes it on and does something special with it. So that's actually the story of what happens with this horse called Darkside, who the horse trainer rescues from essentially slaughter and trains up to be a winning horse again.
There have obviously been kind of recent debates, kind of taking this in a different direction, but there have been like recent debates around kind of horse racing itself and the, I guess, the ethical issues involved with that. I'm quite interested kind of from an, obviously you've kind of approached horse racing new with this book. Has the book and the kind of insight it gives into horse racing changed your opinions on that or given you a new perspective?
I think that might be one of the limitations of the format, in the sense that it gives these details but doesn't explore them critically in the way you would in a diary. You know, it's, this is the way the world is, and you probably wouldn't go at length kind of discussing the ethical dimensions of it. But there were certainly details that I read and I thought, you know, that sounds cruel, that sounds horrible. And I wouldn't expect a book of this format to delve into the ethical debates on that. But I think for me, it kind of, if anything, it reaffirmed my questions about ethical practice in horse racing. Because certainly these horses are treated as commodities throughout the book. And I think the narrator stands out for their more compassionate side, but that kind of puts sharper focus on the more brutal elements of this competitive world.
So obviously, Johnny, you mentioned that you were kind of a novice going into reading this book, and Julia Vatland kind of similar thoughts as well, not you know, having ventured into the world of rugby that much before. But Alicia, you're a bit of a snooker guru. And so reading Ronnie O'Sullivan's book...
I quite like that name. I think it rings a bell.
Yeah. I guess going into something that you're really passionate about, you know a lot about, you're a fan of Ronnie O'Sullivan himself, what was your kind of experience reading a book, both in a critical way, but also as someone who's got a sort of horse in the race, to borrow it?
I don't think I can have a critical eye, Sam. I'm going to be honest there. I wasn't sure what to expect, to be honest, but I was afraid that because I've followed Ronnie's career for a really long time, that I might already know him, let's say. But I'm going to be honest, the book really did surprise me. I was saying at the beginning that there was a lot of challenges because people think they know a lot about Ronnie. So, for example, you know, in the media, you think he coasts through everything on his sheer talent and that's it, rather than his hard work. But in fact, he is hard work and he does care about snooker, as you'll find out in the book, which I think is going to win, by the way.
Yeah, you've mentioned that already. I wanted to ask, obviously, with a personality like Ronnie, who is quite guarded with the media, how kind of insightful can a book like this be, where he gets to kind of tell his story on his own terms?
So, Johnny, that's a great question. So it's actually ghost written, and if you think you know Ronnie, so I think I do, as a fan, you'll hear that when you're reading the book, you can hear his voice in your head. And what's really great about the book is it's in a chronological order. So all the chapters are completely different. There's a lot of anecdotes appeared, and I didn't think that would be expected. So there's a lot of chapters where he addresses big elements of his life, such as his family, his running, and basically being a professional snooker player. You really, really do need to read this book because it gives you a real insight on what goes on in the mind of a genius at work. The GOAT, as we call him, Ronnie O'Sullivan.
So again, just like rugby, I know very little about snooker. That's not a sport we have in America, I don't think, or it's not very popular. Would someone like me be able to read it? And
100%, Julia. So what's great about the book is you can read all the chapters independently in no particular order. So each subject that is important to Ronnie as a person or a snooker player reflects on each chapter, basically. So there's a particular theme that might be important to him and how it might have impacted his life and changed him as a person. So, for example, one of the themes that I absolutely loved the most was him reflecting about the Crucible, which is the home of snooker. So that is the first thing I would say. You need to go take a trip to Sheffield and see the Crucible Theatre.
Well, Alicia, so you spoke about what comes across in this book is that a lot of people think they know Ronnie O'Sullivan, but they don't. So do you think the theme, is it more of somewhat you think that he feels disappointed that a lot of people have misunderstood him over the years? Or do you think that is just he doesn't care about that and is just about him wanting to tell a story?
I think once you get to know him, definitely through the book, you'll find out that he is a child prodigy. And, you know, throughout his younger years, he has really accepted his addictions. And some people might not know, but he did have addictions, anxiety, and, you know, what it takes to really be a winner. He is a loving person. He's got a great family and great relationship with his children. And he's actually dedicated this book to his partner, Layla, which is a fantastic thing where you wouldn't think he talks about his private life. He doesn't in the book, but what a lovely book to dedicate it to.
The title of the book, Unbreakable, what do you think that kind of actually means, and how does that title actually sort of sum up the book and contribute to how he sort of frames his whole life?
So to wrap this up, really, I was reading a quote from Stephen Fry, and he said, reading this book is like watching an O'Sullivan break. It's hypnotic, dazzling, and impossible to tear yourself away from. And I completely agree. When will the world fully realise that Ronnie O'Sullivan is one of the top three greatest sportsmen alive? A GOAT in the same field as Tiger Woods and Roger Federer.
So obviously you seem to be quite a big fan of Ronnie O'Sullivan, but let's say that I'm not his biggest fan. You know, I think he's robbing Catherine Scanlon of the award she deserves. Do you think someone with a more cynical eye on Ronnie would be as excited about the book as you are, or do you think they would be more inclined to see it as his version of events rather than the true version of events?
I think they'll think it's an easy read, to be honest. I often found myself thinking, oh, I want to read this again tomorrow. And I think someone reading this book, not into snooker or wanting to find out about his story or message, will absorb all the layers about Ronnie O'Sullivan. Anyone listening, it's a compelling book and it's beautifully put together that shows us there's so much more to Ronnie O'Sullivan, his outrageous natural talent. He's as fascinating as a human as he is a player, and you should all read it. And we're going to win tomorrow. So if Ronnie O'Sullivan listens to this, Ronnie, your book's going to win.
I love that it's become a "we're going to win tomorrow" as if you're part of the book. So I don't know if we can tell, but Alicia does think that Unbreakable is going to win. I don't know if we got that across.
Imagine if Ronnie's there to take the award, which I don't think he is.
But as a group here...
Never say never.
As a group here, do we agree? Do we think? I don't know. Ayush was a pretty good salesperson for his book. I also think...
I vote Ronnie.
I also think, like, Concussed is just a very of-the-moment type of book. It really is very topical. I feel like we've had a lot of events across football, American football, rugby. It's a very globally relatable book. So I can see Sam Peters having a good shot. What do people think after our discussion?
I would, as much as I enjoyed Kick the Latch, I would question how likely it is to win. I think maybe in these other books, the depth given to a kind of particular issue is something that Kick the Latch can't really match with its format, even though it is kind of topical and relevant to the way that women experience sport and male-dominated kind of arenas in that regard. But yeah, I would suggest Kick the Latch probably won't get the win. What do you think, Sam?
I think maybe Kick the Latch has sort of won in a slightly different way, in terms of its legacy will be that, you know, fictional works and these kind of books do have a space in what's normally dominated by autobiographies or biographies or things like this. So I think in that respect, it sounds like Kick the Latch may have already won in a certain way. I suppose, as Ayush and I have said, I'm a massive advocate for the Althea Gibson book, and I really think that's going to make a neat push for the crown on the 30th of November when the winner will be announced. So yeah, I suppose it's exciting to have, you know, heard everyone's thoughts and seen how we're all doing. Laura, any final words?
Yeah, I just kind of wanted to put across that I'd be quite sad hearing some of the books that you've been reading and how kind of inspiring they are and how important they are in touching on some really key issues in sport. I think for me, I'd be quite personally quite sad, and it would be quite a sad indictment on the way of sports writing if my book were to win. I wouldn't personally advocate for it in the same way, and I would hope that people can kind of either approach it with the kind of open lens of, I'm not going to take everything this book says if they do want to read it, but not necessarily even read it.
Well, while I really want Althea to win, and I think I'm going to start a Sally Jacobs fan club after this, but I think Good for a Girl is also a really good shout if Althea does not end up winning. George really told us so many about the really important topics that it has touched upon, and I'd like to see that. I'd like to see Good for a Girl win as well.
So it seems like we have no consensus of who we think's gonna win.
Unbreakable.
But maybe have a couple what we think are front runners, maybe two that we think are less likely to win. I think this is the last pitch I'll have for Concussed. I think it is in line with maybe some previous winners. It's very similar. So maybe it would be more exciting if we got something a little bit new. But I'm excited to see how the awards go on the 30th.
I'm so excited as well, Julia. What do you think, Johnny?
I think it's we've given the audience all they need to know ahead of those awards. It's been a very successful first episode of the Sports Gazette Book Club, and we will be at the William Hill Sports Book of the Year Award, ready to celebrate who wins, unless Laura's book wins. Thank you for listening.